Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today we have an update on the presidential primaries for you and some news about visits by one candidate and another candidate's famous husband to the San Diego area this weekend. We'll have some news for you about Donald Trump's proposed Supreme Court nominees and about an important ballot initiative being backed by Bernie Sanders. From Public News Service, we'll have some international and national news, including the latest on the disappearance of that Egyptian airline and the Zika virus. On Green Scene, hear about indictments against the company responsible for that recent Santa Barbara oil spill. Then on Destination East County, we'll have all the most fun festivals and events coming up for you across our region this week and later this month. And finally, in honor of the 62nd anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, the landmark Supreme Court case, today we'll be re-airing our interview with Roberto Alvarez, whose family helped to integrate a school right here in Lemon Grove in East County. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with an update on the presidential campaign trail. Both Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders will pick up 27 delegates apiece in the Kentucky primary, with 100% of precincts counted. Clinton received 46.8% of the vote and Sanders 46.3%, just a half of a percentage point difference. In Oregon, Senator Sanders scored victory with 56% of the vote, while Clinton took 44%. Sanders will get 34 delegates and Clinton 25 delegates, Associated Press reports. Donald Trump won the Oregon Republican primary, but even with all other Republican competitors dropped out, he still scored only 66.6%, with a third of voters casting votes for other candidates who were no longer in the race. Trump picked up 17 delegates overall. The Kentucky outcome is a disappointment for Clinton, who won Kentucky during the 2008 primary by 35 points over Barack Obama. But she still has a nearly insurmountable lead with 1,768 pledged delegates to Sanders, who has 1,494. Clinton also has 525 of the 712 superdelegates, though Sanders has 39 pledged to him. On June 7th, Super Tuesday, voters in California, New Jersey, Montana, New Mexico, North Dakota, and South Dakota will all head to the polls for Democratic primaries. Republicans will also hold primaries in all of those states except North Dakota. Now, California, with 546 delegates, is by far the biggest prize remaining in the still-contended Democratic primary. Sanders would need overwhelming victories in California and other states to have any chance of convincing superdelegates to shift votes. Meanwhile, some party leaders are pressing Sanders to work toward uniting the party, but Sanders has pledged to carry his campaign all the way to the Democratic convention in July. He's campaigning hard in California, including stops in San Diego this weekend. Meanwhile, in an interview with Fox News, billionaire Donald Trump made clear that he considers claims of past womanizing by former President Bill Clinton, including a rape allegation, to be fair game in the campaign. Some Democratic insiders have voiced concerns over the negative fodder that a Clinton candidacy would give Trump, including the FBI investigation of Clinton's emails and questions over potential improprieties involving the Clinton Foundation funding. Some have suggested that Sanders may be the stronger candidate to beat Trump, citing recent polls that show Sanders faring better against Trump than Clinton would in a general election, and Clinton losing by up to 5 points, according to some of those polls. But others argue that Clinton has already been tested by fire during her husband's presidency, weathering scandals ranging from Whitewater to impeachment proceedings, and that she is the candidate who is toughest and thus best prepared to stand up against Trump's bullying style. Clinton loyalists contend that Sanders has not been a target for Trump during the primary and could fall in popularity despite his surge in the recent primary races if Trump were to take aim at Sanders in a general election matchup.
Both Democratic presidential candidates' campaigns will be holding events in San Diego this weekend, gearing up for the June 7th primary election. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders will hold a Future to Believe In rally at Kimball Park in National City Saturday evening that is open to the public. No tickets are required, though RSVPs are recommended. Doors will open at 4:30 for the 7:30 p.m. rally. On Sunday, Sanders will also appear at Rancho Buena Vista High School in Vista. Doors open at 11 a.m. for the 2 p.m. rally. If you want to see Bill Clinton, however, you'd better have a lot of cash on hand, since he'll be headlining a fundraiser for Hillary in the Inn at Rancho Santa Fe on Saturday, with suggested donations ranging from $1,000 to $2,700 per person. This weekend's visit will be Senator Sanders' second stop in San Diego, where he drew a crowd of 17,000 people on his last campaign stop. Neither Hillary Clinton nor the likely Republican nominee, Donald Trump, have appeared yet in San Diego during their 2016 campaigns. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Meridian Broaddus.
The death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has left the high court split 4-4 among conservative and liberal justices. The Republican-controlled Senate has refused to hold hearings on President Barack Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, a judicial moderate, or any other Obama nominee during the president's remaining time in office. Now, likely Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has released a list of 11 judges he says he would consider for nomination to the Supreme Court if he wins the election in November. In addition to the current vacancy on the High Court, other openings are likely to occur during the next president's term of office due to the advanced age of several current justices. So the next president's nominations and the actions of the Senate will likely have a big impact on how the laws of the land are interpreted for decades to come. Trump's choices are all conservatives. Reaction has been mixed, with Senator Charles Grassley, Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and the Conservative Judicial Crisis Network praising some of the potential nominees as justices who would uphold the Constitution and conservative values. But progressives criticized the list, characterizing Trump's choices as extremists who would dismantle civil rights and liberties as well as women's reproductive rights. Trump's nominees include 6 federal judges appointed by President George W. Bush and 5 state Supreme Court justices, all conservatives. Most are not prominent in legal circles. Some have voiced controversial opinions. For instance, Alabama Judge William Pryor has called Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court case that legalized most abortions, quote, the worst abomination in the history of constitutional law, unquote. Another potential nominee on Trump's list, Don Willett of Texas, worked for the Bush White House's Office of Faith-Based Initiatives and later the Texas government, where he fought to keep a Ten Commandments monument on public property. Ironically, Willett has mocked Trump on Twitter, including a tweet asking who Trump might nominate for the Supreme Court. Willett tweeted, quote, the mind reels, weeps, can't finish tweet, unquote. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
United States Senator Bernie Sanders on Tuesday backed a California ballot initiative that aims to save state taxpayers from price gouging by pharmaceutical companies, which charge Americans the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. While Congress has failed to stand up to the greed of the pharmaceutical industry, the people of California can by supporting this ballot initiative, the Vermont senator said, adding, Americans living with HIV/AIDS and cancer should not live in fear that they will go bankrupt because of the outrageously high costs of their prescription drugs. The California Drug Price Relief Act is supported by the AIDS Healthcare Foundation and National Nurses United. The pharmaceutical industry is bankrolling a campaign to defeat the California initiative, pouring $50 million into the effort. The proposition, if approved by California voters, would prohibit the state from paying more for a prescription drug than the lowest price paid for the same drug by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. The nationwide VA healthcare system negotiates lower prices for pharmaceuticals. As former chairman of the U.S. Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, Sanders authored landmark legislation reforming the healthcare system for veterans. He offers this insight. We know that the VA pays considerably less than retail prices for prescription drugs. The people of California and all Americans should get the same price. Prices for prescription medicine in the United States soared more than 10% last year, the third consecutive year of double-digit price increases. 1 out of 5 adults between age 18 and 64, more than 35 million Americans, cannot afford medication that their doctors prescribe. In the richest country in the history of the world, Sanders said, that is unacceptable. In Congress, Sanders and Representative Elijah Cummings have introduced comprehensive legislation to lower the cost of prescription drugs. Their bills would authorize the Secretary of Health and Human Services to negotiate drug prices with pharmaceutical companies nationwide and reduce barriers to importation of lower-cost drugs from Canada and other countries. Sanders and Cummings have also spotlighted steep price increases for generic drugs. The increases cost taxpayers an additional $1.4 billion over the last decade, according to a study they requested from the U.S. Department of Health and Services Inspector General. Prices of top-selling generic drugs rose faster than inflation 22% of the time over the 10-year period examined by the study. Sanders issued his statement supporting the California Drug Price Relief Act while in California this week ahead of the state's June 7th presidential primary election. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Next up, we have some important international and national news headlines from Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, May 20th, 2016. I'm Mark Richardson. Another airline mystery tops our news as officials continue to search for an Egyptair jetliner with 66 people aboard, which veered wildly in flight and crashed into the Mediterranean Sea. Officials say it may have been brought down by terrorists. There were no signs of survivors. Egyptair Flight 804 was en route from Paris when it went down about halfway between the Greek island of Crete and Egypt's coastline. Radar indicates that the plane spun all the way around and suddenly lost altitude before it vanished. Meanwhile, officials in California are planning to dramatically roll back strict mandatory water conservation rules imposed at the height of the state's multi-year drought. They say a wet winter eased conditions in part of the state. California's Water Resources Board voted to end mandatory conservation of up to 36% in many communities, moving instead to a system under which only regions where a shortage is anticipated will need to conserve. Lawmakers in Oklahoma approved a bill Thursday that would make performing abortions a felony and revoke the medical licenses of most physicians who assist in such procedures. The sweeping measure, which opponents describe as unconstitutional, now heads to Republican Governor Mary Fallon. She'll have 5 days to decide whether to sign the bill, veto it, or allow it to become law without her signature. Funding cuts to higher education have driven up tuition, making college less affordable and less accessible to many students. That according to a new national report. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says with inflation factored in, states on average are spending 17% less on higher education than they did when the recession hit in 2008. The state of Kentucky is spending about 32% less. The report's author, Michael Mitchell, says almost every state is now trying to reinvest in college, while a few states, including Kentucky, are going backwards.
Unfortunately, for students, when it comes to tuition, when it comes to quality of schools, it puts in question whether or not those things will be there, affordability and quality, moving forward.
The report shows that 37 states increased college funding over the last year, but Kentucky is one of only 3 states to make cuts. Mitchell says when states cut funding, student debt goes up, meaning many graduates are forced to postpone life events such as buying a house or a car or starting a business. Public health officials in Texas are warning that the Zika virus is almost certainly on its way there this summer, and it could have a devastating effect on impoverished communities in coastal and border cities. Experts told state lawmakers this week that Zika cases contracted through mosquito bites would likely start showing up as early as June. Peter Hotez, dean of Baylor College of Medicine's School of Tropical Medicine, says if a pregnant woman contracts the virus, it can block the development of her baby's brain.
This is what I've been calling the virus from hell. It's really every parent's nightmare. It crosses over into their placentas and ultimately halts the development of their baby's brain. I can't think of a more nightmarish scenario.
Officials with the state health department say there have already been 35 confirmed cases of Zika in Texas, but almost all of them were contracted by people who traveled to infected areas of Central and South America. They say the disease will spread much faster once it's transmitted by the mosquito population. They're urging state officials to begin a mosquito eradication program sooner rather than later. And that's the news. I'm Mark Richardson for Public News Service, publicnewsservice.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, East County Magazine.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Environmental groups are applauding the criminal indictment Tuesday of the company blamed for the massive oil spill last May in Refugio, about an hour north of Santa Barbara. A grand jury indicted Plains All American Pipeline on 46 counts related to the spill. In addition, one employee is charged with a misdemeanor for not reporting the incident quickly enough. Ashley Blako with the conservation advocacy group Oceana says once oil is spilled, it's impossible to completely clean it up.
Companies that extract these public resources have to be held accountable for the safety of those operations. And when a spill does occur, there's a price to pay to clean up the damage that's done.
Plains All American released a statement saying while it regrets the accidental spill, its actions are not criminal in nature. The company notes that it has spent $150 million to mitigate the impact of the spill, which occurred after a severely corroded underground pipe owned by the company cracked, sending 140,000 gallons of heavy crude onto the beach. Kristen Monsell with the Center for Biological Diversity says the situation calls for more wide-ranging changes.
All the indictments in the world aren't going to change the fact that oil drilling and transportation is inherently dangerous and doesn't belong in our fragile coastal environment. Both the state and the federal government need to start decommissioning all of this aging offshore infrastructure.
The Oiled Wildlife Care Network reported more than 200 birds and 100 marine mammals were killed and many more injured in the spill. Plains All American could face $2.8 million in fines. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Rebecca Williamson.
And Leon Thompson, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes the Ramona Rodeo and Parade, America on Main Street in El Cajon, a show by the Rhinestone Grannies, the Catfish Opener at Lake Jennings, and more.
Plus, we'll have previews of coming attractions, including the Santee Street Fair and Craft Beer Festival, a Cactus Garden Festival at the Weghorst Museum, the Julian Fiddlin' Pickin' Contest, the La Mesa Flag Day Parade, the Taste of La Mesa, Boars and Brew along the San Diego River, concerts, live theater shows, and outdoor movies, all part of the summer fun here in East County.
So stay tuned for all of these events and much, much more. The Ramona Rodeo takes place on May 19th through 22nd, along with other activities, including a parade down Main Street on the 21st and dancing to the country band Patrick Howard Trampas on the 20th and 21st after the rodeo. There's also a free slack rodeo performance on the 19th, as well as a kids' day on the 22nd, featuring the youngest cowboys and cowgirls riding sheep in the mutton-busting competition. Adult rodeo events include bull riding, bareback riding, barrel racing, a tie-down competition, steer wrestling, and more. Winners may advance to the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association National Rodeo Championship. For tickets and details, you can visit RamonaRodeo.net.
The City of El Cajon invites you to bring the family to its fun, patriotic event, America on Main Street. This year's event has the theme, The Beach Comes East, and will be held on Saturday, May 21st from 12 noon to 8 p.m., coinciding with the National Armed Forces Day. The festivities include three stages with live entertainment, a Ferris wheel, food booths, a chili cook-off featuring police versus firemen, arts and crafts, a petting zoo. For details, you can visit AmericanMainStreet.org.
What better way to celebrate Older Americans Month than with singing, dancing, and comedy from fabulous ladies of a certain age? The Rhinestone Grannies will be giving a lively and hilarious performance on Sunday, May 22nd at 2 p.m. in the El Cajon Library, located in downtown El Cajon.
Lake Jennings will hold its catfish opener on Friday, May 27th. The lake will open at 4 p.m. instead of the usual 6 a.m. and will close at midnight. 2,000 pounds of catfish will be stocked for this event. You're invited to come, drop a line, and try to catch a whopper. A full-size lantern is required for each party after 8 p.m. Boats are first come, first serve, and only registered campers will be allowed to fish the campground shoreline during the day on Friday, May 27th, before the catfish opener begins at 4 p.m. For more information, you can visit lakejennings.org.
Croc Kids Junior Theater presents Peter Pan Jr. on May 27th and 28th at 7 p.m., plus a 2 p.m. matinee on May 29th. Based on the Disney film and J.M. Barrie's enchanting play, Peter Pan Jr. is a modern version of the timeless tale about a boy who wouldn't grow up, with no flying required. The score includes new arrangements of classic Disney songs and a story featuring one rousing adventure after another. Wendy Darling loves to tell stories to her brothers Michael and John, but when her father announces she must move out of the nursery, Peter Pan comes to visit the children and whisks them away to Never Never Land. Their journey introduced them to the Lost Boys, mermaids, Indians, and even the infamous pirate Captain Hook. It's Peter to the rescue when Wendy is taken captive by the captain, who has his own sinister plans in mind for our hero. For tickets and more details, you can check out sdcroccenter.org, and that's Croc spelled K-R-O-C. Now for a preview of coming attractions.
The Santee Street Fair and Craft Beer Festival draws over 30,000 visitors each year, with patriotic fun for the whole family. The 8th annual festival will be held this year on Saturday, May 28th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Riverview Parkway and Town Center Parkway in Santee. The festival will feature local breweries and honor the military on the Heroes stage. Festival highlights include a craft beer festival, live music and entertainment, a crafter row and artist alley, over 300 food and vendor booths, carnival rides, and games for the family. For details or tickets, visit SanteeStreetFair.com.
The Mission Trails Regional Park Foundation welcomes acclaimed musician Gregory Page performing his one-man show on Sunday, May 29th from 3 to 4 p.m. at Mission Trails Regional Park's Visitor Center. You're invited to rewind to a bygone era with an afternoon of endearing, enduring, enchanting, and entertaining music by the one and only Gregory Page. He's a London-born croonador, that's crooner plus troubadour, and recording artist. The Gregory Page songbook has been featured in film, on television, the BBC, and NPR's Prairie Home Companion. He is an international touring artist and has performed his one-man show in Europe to both critical and popular acclaim. For more information, you can visit the Mission Trails website at mtrp.org.
You're invited to have a ropin' good time at the Cactus Garden Barbecue at the Olaf Weekhorst Museum, a hidden gem in downtown El Cajon. On June 4th and 5th, from 5 until 9 p.m., Sons of Charity, Inc. will celebrate famed artist Olaf Weekhorst's iconic art and our region's Western heritage with a cowboy barbecue and concert by Smith & Western. This event benefits families battling childhood cancer and school programs offered by the museum to promote literacy. Also, savor tasty libations, enjoy a live and silent auction, and an outdoor concert to boot. For more information, you can visit WeekhorstMuseum.org.
The California Old Time Fiddlers Association invites you to the Julian Fiddle and Pickin' Contest on Saturday and Sunday, June 4th and 5th, plus a Saturday night performance by two-time national fiddle champions. There's also a warm-up workshop on Friday, June 3rd, led by a national grand fiddle champion. Whether you're a fiddler, picker, or just a spectator, there's plenty of fun in Julian, with jamming throughout the town during the contest weekend. If you play, you're encouraged to bring yourself and your instrument and be prepared to smile all day long and all night long. For a full schedule and details, you can visit sandiegofiddler.org.
The city of La Mesa shows its patriotic spirit with the La Mesa Flag Day Parade on Saturday, June 4th, 2016. This annual community-supported event is held along La Mesa Boulevard through the downtown village. This year's theme is the Salute to Old Glory, and the Grand Marshal will be Cabrillo National Park in honor of the National Park Service's 100th anniversary. Pre-parade concerts start at 9 a.m. featuring local middle school bands. The parade rolls out at 10 a.m. Afterwards, a community ice cream social will be held at La Mesa Boulevard and 4th Street. For more information, you can visit the City of La Mesa's website.
The La Mesa Chamber of Commerce will host its 8th Annual Taste of La Mesa on Monday, June 6th from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the La Mesa Community Center. The public is invited to sample fare from many local restaurants and other food providers. Early bird rates are in effect through May 31st. For tickets and reservations, you can visit lamesachamber.com.
In celebration of Hemp History Week, a hemp road trip bus will be rolling out in East County on Monday, June 6th from 12 until 2 p.m. from the parking lot at Mountain Hempire in Alpine. Festivities will include a showing of the movie Bringing It Home, as well as tie-dye t-shirt making and food provided by Good Seed Hemp, including burgers, hot dogs, and popcorn. For details, you can check mthempire.com.
The City of Santee announces PhytoFest, a Pause in the Park event on June 11th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 550 Park Center Drive in Santee. This event features activities for both pups and people, including a mega adoption event with pups from several rescue organizations, plus an opportunity drawing to benefit dogs on deployment. For more information, you can visit the City of Santee's website.
The Olaf Weghorst Museum and Western Heritage Center in El Cajon will host a show of nationally known local artists, including Gloria Chadwick and Grace Schlesier, starting in June. And Art After Five, Meet the Artist opening reception will be held on Thursday, June 16th from 5 until 8. For more information, you can visit weghorstmuseum.org.
Christian Youth Theater will present the 9th Annual San Diego Follies on June 16th through 19th at the Helix Main Stage Theater at Helix High School in La Mesa, San Diego's largest musical revue spectacle with dazzling costumes, scenery, and lighting. This year's Time Warp show will feature hilarious skits, musical numbers, flashy dancing, and a live band. For tickets, you can visit cytsandiego.org.
Lakeside's River Park Conservancy in Lakeside will host its second annual Boars and Brew on Saturday, June 18th from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. You're invited to sip and stroll along the banks of the San Diego River at this event, which drew over 600 guests last year and also includes tasty foods. Guests will receive a complimentary mug for tasting. Discounted rates are available for designated drivers. For tickets and details, visit LakesideRiverPark.org.
The City of La Mesa's Family Fun Outdoor Concerts at 6 series will be held once again in Harry Griffin Park each Sunday evening from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. The series opens on June 12th and runs through July 24th. For the season opener, the San Diego Concert Band will be performing. Other musical entertainment through the season will include Rhythm and the Method, Jazz West, Sonic Epidemic, Silver Mine, and the Big Band Ambassadors.
Movies and More by the Lake presents Lights, Camera, Beagle, the Peanuts movie on Friday, June 24th from 6 p.m. to approximately 9:30 p.m. at Santee Lakes. The cast of Young Actors Theater will perform songs from the movie, plus check out Lucy's psychiatric booth and batting practice on an inflatable batting cage. There will also be food, games, and plenty of fun. For more information, you can visit SanteeLakes.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more on our calendar and in our Festivals and Events section online at eastcountymagazine.org. If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This week marks the 62nd anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education, which led to desegregation of schools across the land. But long before Brown versus Board of Education, there was a landmark school integration case right here in East County in the city of Lemon Grove. And today we're going to replay our interview with Roberto Alvarez, who was a child in the school at the center of that controversy and whose parents helped fight for the right to equal public education for all children.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, the Network for Social Justice. Guest hosting today our Sounds of History segment on the East County Magazine Show. My very special guest today is Roberto Alvarez. Roberto is a professor emeritus of ethnic studies at the University of California, San Diego, and he's here today to talk to us about some amazing things that he found out while researching his own family history and discovering their role in what's become known as the Lemon Grove Incident. Roberto, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Now, tell us a little bit about your own family background, for starters, when your grandparents came to this country.
My grandparents, along with many of the community of Lemon Grove, migrated from Baja California. And it took a long time, you know, a period of, you know, decades to move through a mining district into California. And they crossed the border around 1900, the early decades of the 1900s.
Mm-hmm. So their children were born here. They were all citizens here when the 1930s rolled around. Tell us, when you were doing your college dissertation on immigration, what you found out.
Well, I decided to do my PhD dissertation, and it is in anthropology, on immigration, because there was very little being written at the time on immigration.
Yeah.
From a humanitarian and anthropological perspective. Most of the work had been done on economics, on the economic push-pull of the larger forces of immigration.
Yeah, so there were no human stories.
No, there were not. There were very few. There were some very early ones in the 1920s that were done. But my reaction was that what I was reading in the literature did not reflect my own background or the background of my family. So I decided to do my dissertation on immigration and do a social history of the migration of my own family into California. During that time, when I began doing the dissertation, I interviewed people who I thought I knew, but these were people that had incredibly full and rich backgrounds that I didn't know about. And I learned of more of the connections of the family within San Diego County and also across the border. In that interviewing, I discovered that people spoke about the school case. And this is something that I had never heard about, or any of my generation had really heard about either. And when I asked my father, what is this school case thing? He said, well, it was a case that occurred in segregation, Lemon Grove.
And this was a case that overturned the segregation of a Lemon Grove school. And it turns out that your father, who is also named Roberto Alvarez, was just 9 years old at the time. And it was your grandparents who were among the plaintiffs that filed this landmark case.
That's correct. The community was very unified. And part of this was because they all had known each other through the migration trail. When they got to Lemon Grove, they lived in one section of town. And when they learned of the segregation, they formed what they called the Asociación de Vecinos de Lemon Grove, the Lemon Grove Neighborhood Association, and basically took the case to court.
Basically what happened was these children at one time were in the main school in Lemon Grove. Along came a school board that voted to move all the Mexican-American children, even citizens, into a separate school, a segregated school. This in an era 20 years before the Brown versus Board of Education case in the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1950s eventually overturned segregation nationwide. In that case, it was a school for African-American children. Quite a historic action right
here. It is. However, it's interesting that the principal, Jerome Green, was not in favor of the segregation. It was the school board.
So tell us how the parents reacted when the school board built this separate school.
The parents learned about the upcoming segregation. There was a school being built. They called it a school, a building in the Mexican area that was being built specifically for the Mexican-American kids, which they called La Caballeriza, which means the barn.
The barn.
Or the barn or the barnyard. They were incensed, basically, that their children, who they felt deserved to be with other American citizens in the regular school, should be put in a different school. So Juan Gonzalez was also very principal in this, in addition to all the families. But Juan Gonzalez had some dealings with a lawyer in Sonora, I believe it was, who helped with the case. The association got together, and they went to the Mexican consul and ask for support. And the support that they receive from the consul is kind of tenuous because Mexico can't get involved in U.S. affairs. But it was Fred Noon was the name of the lawyer. Fred Noon took on the case. So anyway, they were very adamant about what they were going to be doing.
And while the lawsuit was working its way through the court, the parents didn't just stand by idly doing nothing. I understand your grandmother was instrumental in this, but they actually pulled their kids out of the school, I understand, and went on strike. Had the kids go on strike.
Well, what happened was they chose I think it was the day after Christmas vacation to separate the kids and take them over to the new school, the Mexican kids. And the principal stood at the door and separated the kids, the Mexican kids from the Anglo kids. And the story is that when he went into the school to place the Anglo kids, the Mexican kids just came home and they were instructed by their parents not to go to the other school. That's what began the strike. It lasted for several months, I believe.
So they really stood up and took a stand.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Very inspiring. This should be put against the historical backdrop of the times. This was not an isolated case. Tell us a little bit about the historical context of segregation in the era, as well as the anti-immigrant actions that were taking place across America during the 1930s, which was, of course, the Great Depression.
That's really a very important question. And you need to remember that there are some parallels here with what's going on today.
Definitely.
There was a very strong anti-immigrant sense in the country, that the Depression was basically forcing great competition for jobs, of course, and it threatened the larger population. Mexican immigrants were seen as troublemakers, health problems.
Sounds a lot like a Donald Trump speech, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, what happened was that there were almost 500,000 Mexican and Mexican-Americans deported.
Yeah, whole families, I understand.
Families, they were rounded up in Los Angeles in the parks. It was the Hoover administration that initiated that deportation.
Yeah, basically the Donald Trump plan brought to reality way back in the 1930s.
I guess you could say that, but what happened was that during that period of time, there was a tremendous anti-Mexican sentiment. There was a governor's report that came out in 1930. That basically it was called Mexicans in California. It didn't say anything of Mexican Americans or citizens. Everybody was lumped, whether they were citizens or not, as people of Mexican origin.
Yeah.
So that the problem became one of all people of Mexican origin, not just immigrants. So that the people that were deported, and there were people from Lemon Grove that were actually deported who were citizens,
citizens
during that period of time into Mexico. So it's sort of like the Trump thing. And what's frightening, however, is that
almost worse in a sense, because they even deported citizens back.
Well, they
then.
Did deport citizens, but it's that same mentality.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and the mentality itself really isn't new. It's gone on for hundreds of years, unfortunately. When the Irish were coming over to work the railroads, or the Chinese, there was anti-immigrant sentiment against them, the Japanese during World War II. Why do you think it is that it seems like whenever times are hard, we also seem to see this rise in anti-immigrant sentiment against whichever group is, has the influx of population at the time?
Well, I believe it's like what I mentioned before, it's really a threat to the so-called majority. And it's basically the white majority. People, the same arguments were being made in the 1930s. The same arguments were made with the Chinese Exclusion Act, et cetera. They're taking our jobs. They have health problems. They cause troubles. They're criminals, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a threat to, the ideology of America, that these people who are not really American are causing all these problems and issues.
Yeah. And yet almost all of us, unless we're Native American, are descended from immigrants somewhere down the chain. Back to the case in the 1930s. So this moved forward to the courts. The kids went out on strike. They were out for what, 6 months? And your father was one of those?
It was, I believe it was about 6 months.
Yeah. And your dad was how old at the time?
He was nine.
Nine years old.
Years old, right.
What an ordeal for a young child at the time.
I'd like to return to the historical context.
Yes.
Because in addition to being in the Depression period, this was a time when segregation throughout the country was pretty rampant. We have the Jim Crow law, right?
Yeah.
Separate but equal. But this was occurring throughout the Southwest as well. I think that the Lemon Grove school case was one of a good example of that.
I'm curious, given all of these Jim Crow laws. And this was not the only school in California that was segregating out Mexican-American children. There had even been some court cases that backed up the discrimination. What made your grandparents and the other parents that decided to go forward with this case do so? What made them believe they could win?
That's really a good question. I think they just had a lot of integrity. Mm-hmm. And they knew where they were. They knew who their children were. They knew that they were citizens and had rights as citizens in this country.
Yeah, so very courageous action. So ultimately, tell us which court made the decision and what it was.
It was at the court here in San Diego, the Superior Court of San Diego County. The decision was that it was indeed a case of segregation. Interestingly, during this period, which again illustrates sort of the long haul of Jim Crow, it was illegal to segregate white children. And at the time, Mexican Americans were considered white.
Interesting.
So that I've heard arguments that, well, they won because they were white. But it goes back to your earlier question that, you know, it took a lot of guts and stamina for those parents to stand up against the school board, given the time that they were in.
And we should note that not every white person in Lemon Grove supported what the school board was doing. In fact, the principal, you've told me, opposed it.
Not at all. In fact, my father said that most of the families were against this kind of a segregated move. It was mainly the school board, for personal reasons, that was really pushing this.
Yeah, some of the comments seemed very racist as the true motivation, but it was interesting because ostensibly in court, the school district tried to argue that this was really in the best interest of the Mexican-American kids because they didn't speak English and they were going to get more help in this school, which was really a shack we're putting them into, and that keeping them in the main school would slow down the progress of the white kids. And the judge did a pretty interesting, pretty effective job of tearing apart those arguments. He asked them, what do you do when you have a slow learner that's a white kid? And of course, they don't segregate them out and send them off to their own school. And so he concluded that, in fact, this was racist and segregation. And he ordered the school to be desegregated 20-something years before the landmark Brown versus Board of Education case.
That's right. What's really interesting, however, is that when they went back to the school, they went back to the Mexican classes. You know, I interviewed people who graduated 10 years later from that school who were still talked about being in the Mexican classes. There were a few people like my dad who spoke very good English, and I think Jesse Gonzalez and a few other folks that were placed with the white kids because they spoke English well, and they were light-complected. So anyway, what I'm getting at is there was still a segregation going on in the school. They were separated, which you can't do today, obviously.
Yeah, it didn't.
The case ended the separation of the children from one school to another school.
But not within the classroom.
In a legal you know, sense.
Very interesting.
But when they went back to school, to the regular school, they were back in separated classes.
And for those listeners that may be wondering, why did it take 20-something years for the Supreme Court to strike down segregated schools? It's because the Lemon Grove School Board decided not to file an appeal, so there never was a precedent set that would apply anywhere else. Why do you think they didn't appeal?
Well, apparently, from the research that we've done, they spent a lot of money building the school.
They just couldn't afford it.
They couldn't afford it, and I think that there was maybe one or two people on the school board that were very adamant about pursuing this. Mm-hmm. The rest of the board felt that it was no longer necessary, that it was, and they lost and they should just leave it, let it go.
Now, your family is a true American success story. Your grandparents, as we've mentioned, came here. They picked fruit in the early days in Lemon Grove with all of the orchards and the packing houses that Lemon Grove was known for in those days. And then your father, that 9-year-old boy who was at the center of this firestorm of a case, what did he go on to do when he got done with his schooling?
He was considered one of the hardworking kids around. And he worked for the Stonka brothers, I know that, and got into the grocery business that way. And he joined the Navy and learned bookkeeping in the Navy during the Second World War. And when he returned, he and a cousin, Henry Castellanos, another family that was involved in the school case, went in partners and formed a produce company that became very, very successful and still running today. It's a very successful adventure. He was a very eclectic individual, did a lot of work in Mexico, ended up doing a lot of work throughout the southwestern United States.
I think this is a common story among immigrants where the first generation maybe is laborers, fruit pickers in this case. The son goes on to start a business, serve in the military, run his own produce company, and then the grandson now, you, are a college professor. So quite the success story there. Tell us what happened to some of the other kids that came out of that school and this case.
Well, there were, from that generation, I don't think anyone, there was only a few people, my father and a few others that went to high school, finished high school.
Yeah.
The depression came along and hit pretty hard, and many of the young men went into the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle,
serving our country.
Sure, is a good example of that. So most of that generation did not go on to school. They were successful in terms of being, you know, living in the United States and becoming part of the mainstream, pretty much. There was always, even when I was growing up, there was always some discrimination and so on. But that even occurs today.
Yeah.
So, but you know, I do want to go back to you mentioned that spread of time between Lemon Grove and Brown. Brown versus the board.
Yes.
One of the things that I've come to realize is that when I first learned about the Lemon Grove case, it was an event that none of us knew about in my generation. My parents' generation never even talked about it.
Why do you think that is? Why was it not a story that was passed down through the family, do you believe?
There are two reasons. One, I think, is that my father used to say that it was the parents that did this. It was his parents and the community that was struggled and did this and stood up. They just followed their parents' orders. They did whatever their parents told them to do. They went to court, they went to school, and so on. Retrospectively, I think that he was able to, when we were doing this work, when I actually was doing the research on the school, he took great pride in it and began to speak about it, as well as other people
in
the community.
Yeah, so you went back and talked to him about it when you
came. Oh, absolutely. And we interviewed him. There was a film made. There was a number of things that highlighted the case and made it public.
And we should note that for these efforts that you made to bring this incident to light, you have recently been honored and named a living legend by the San Diego County Library as part of their series honoring citizens here in San Diego County who have done some amazing things in their lifetimes. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. I was humbled by that, and I think it really reflects on the, not just on my father, but on the community that I came out of. I think that endeavor to stand up for your rights, you know, stuck with us.
Absolutely. You've mentioned that you have another friend who recently went on to achieve some great honors. Tell us about that. Another young immigrant of this generation.
I just returned from this last week in Washington, D.C. I went to the Library of Congress because a very close friend, a very intimate friend, Juan Felipe Herrera, was named the Poet Laureate of the United States.
Very good.
He was a son of migrant workers, was born in Fowler, but he spent much time here in San Diego in Logan Heights. He was another individual who struggled and got to school and made it through postgraduate work and became a professor at University of California, Riverside. He was a distinguished professor there. So there are a few of us, but I think that we're the exception. There still needs to be a lot more of us and a lot more exposure about the kinds of work that people like Juan Felipe are doing.
You know, you mentioned exposure. Do you believe that the shifts we've seen in recent years in media toward media outlets where people are tending to sort of self-select media that goes along with their own mindset. In some cases, is that reaffirming prejudices that people have? Are you concerned about a rise in media that does not attempt to follow the fairness doctrine to show all voices or viewpoints that tend to be skewed toward one particular point of view?
I think the media is certainly skewed. All the media to a certain extent. And obviously people listen to what they want to listen to and they like to have their own ideas.
Yeah, and we hear overt hate speech on some of the talk radio in particular.
Well, you can see the sentiment now with Trump. The folks that have that sentiment is being expressed through Donald Trump. But I also think that there is a certain responsibility that we have as individuals and citizens to find out what those differences really are. And I think that comes through our educational system, through being aware of what's going on around us. We seem to focus on those things that suit our own interests rather than branching out a little bit. And I think it really has a lot to do with being able to discern and being educated about what's going on around us so that we can make decisions that are much more logical instead of just...
So you see the educational system as the answer. What about an increase in alternative media outlets such as internet media?
Absolutely.
As well as stations like KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, which is a public educational station.
Obviously, it's the more news that we have, it's just better for people to hear these different things. But the point is, however, that today, you know, everywhere you go, someone's, you're looking at a phone. I took a hike in, Joshua Tree National Monument when it was this big long hike. And I get to the top and everybody has a cell phone.
We do. The kids are all connected.
I mean, there's 20 people up there. Every one of them has a cell phone and they're connected to whatever it is that they're connected to.
Oh, well, social media is huge now. You look at Twitter, it started a revolution practically over
the years. But it almost annihilates the actual place that they're in, the actual situation that they find themselves in.
So there's power in that, though. There can be. I mean, it can be a distraction if you're out hiking and ignoring nature, but there's also power.
Absolutely,
in the ability to
there's
network,
power.
Right?
Absolutely. If you look at how the Middle East arose with Twitter and the fast, you know, the media and so on. If you look at what happened with the Zapatistas, it was all about the media and reaching out across the world, not just in Mexico or the United States. It was about connecting to that larger media to have something change. And,
So what message would you send to listeners out there who may be concerned about the parallels that we're seeing today in the national mindset among many people toward immigrants, that we also saw back in the 1930s when this Lemon Grove desegregation case occurred?
The first thing is that we have to recognize, as in Lemon Grove, it was a minority, a very small minority of individuals who were pushing this idea of segregation and this sort of hate and anti-immigrant sentiment. It's similar today. It's a minority of individuals who have a lot of voice. For the others, people who are out there, and that's most of us, I believe, it's important to know what the facts are. For instance, today, in the entire history of our country, there's less immigration coming across that border than there ever was.
Very true.
And so, but we still hear the idea of building two fences and so on and
borders,
so forth.
Even though immigration is already down.
Even though it's not that adamant. It's really not that severe as people are claiming.
Right, because immigration is down substantially.
It's down substantially. And then you need to look at the contributions that immigrants are making here in this country.
Roberto, you've talked about there being a thread or a stream of cases involving segregation, that Lemon Grove was far from an isolated instance. Tell us about that.
When I first found out about Lemon Grove, because I hadn't known about it, nor my generation had known about it, nor had my parents talked about it, it seemed like an isolated event. So we called it the Lemon Grove Incident. Over the years, however, I've realized that there have been other cases that are tied together over the years. And if you look at it as a larger movement of segregation that ties both black and brown and red and others into the stream.
Yeah, this was an era when we had Native American children being sent off to Indian schools, boarding schools, and black children in all black schools in the South.
Absolutely. So that if you think about it in the long durée, the long stream of history, it begins really in 1850 with Roberts and a case against the Boston School Board, which resulted in Plessy versus Ferguson, which basically resulted in the Jim Crow law, separate but equal.
Yeah.
Well, Jim Crow was also Jose Crow, because throughout the Southwest, Mexicans were also separated exactly as black folks were in the South.
How common were these types of segregated schools in California and the Southwest in that era?
Well, they were very, very common. There were two cases prior to the Lemon Grove case, one in Del Rio, Texas in 1930. There was a 1929 case in Tempe, Arizona that was based on also on segregation.
How did they turn out?
They apparently won. The communities won, but they were overturned in courts afterwards.
And that was appellate courts, but none of them went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
None of them went to the U.S. Supreme Court. But after, and remember, these are immigrant communities who are pretty much in contact.
Yeah, so people were standing up for their rights.
They were standing up for their rights, and I think this is something that we forget about, that there was communication, that people are moving back and forth. We talk about migrants who are moving through these periods, and we never talk about the fact that they're communicating, that they're actually telling people what's going on.
Yeah, there was a national media, a Mexican newspaper at the time, I understand, that was covering the Lemon Grove case and getting support for it, financial support and so forth from all over the country.
That's correct. The La Opinion in Los Angeles. There were letters written to La Opinion from the Lemon Grove school, from the Lemon Grove community, asking for support. 9 years after, in Orange County, California, the Mendez versus Westminster case, and 9 years is not that long, considering the fact that you do have media, you have people moving and so on.
Yeah, and this is before the internet, social media, so it took a while for the word to get around.
But The Mendez case was instrumental, and this is a case of Mexican Americans and segregation. It was instrumental in the Brown versus the Board case.
Really?
During that case, Earl Warren, who was the governor of the state of California, ultimately signed segregation, made it illegal, you know, in California.
Oh, interesting. But, and Earl Warren, of course, so he signed the anti-segregation law here, and he went on to become a very influential justice on the Supreme Court.
He was the Chief Justice, yes, of the Supreme Court during the Brown versus the Board case. Similarly, there were a number of amicus briefs written. These are supports for the plaintiffs, a Jewish American League, the Japanese American League, and a variety of others. And what was included there was also the NAACP.
Do you think these other cases, the other case in California that you just cited, was that influenced at all by the Lemon Grove case? I know it wasn't a legal precedent, but were people connected? Were they hearing what was going on down here? Do you think what happened here maybe inspired people to challenge these laws in other places?
You know, I strongly believe that it was that it was influential.
So the desegregation that started right here in Lemon Grove in San Diego's East County was influential in ultimately helping to overturn segregated schools nationwide through the Brown versus Board of Education case.
In a sense, it was. That's why I emphasize the fact that segregation was going on for a very long time, that it happened in the South. Thurgood Marshall worked with the Texas educators in the 1940s to end segregation in Texas. There was a lot of communication between educators in Texas and Thurgood Marshall at the time.
Mm-hmm. Who became a Supreme Court justice also.
Right.
So Thurgood Marshall was working to end segregation.
Absolutely. The point I'm trying to make is that in the Mendez case, he wrote an amicus brief that basically outlined several of the arguments that were made in the Brown versus the Board that he used in the Brown versus the Board case based on the, you know, constitutional rights of children in the United States to end segregation. So ultimately, Earl Warren from California and Thurgood Marshall, who wrote that amicus brief, sat, you know, in the Supreme Court of the United States and argued, which ended up finally ending segregation in the country. The argument is that the stream of these small cases were not isolated, they were connected, and it was a larger segregation movement that included black and brown folks.
Very good. Listeners, we've been speaking with Roberto Alvarez about his family's role in a landmark case that desegregated the Lemon Grove School back in the 1930s. I want to give you the final words today, Roberto. Thank you so much for joining us. What can people who are concerned about the immigrant bashing that we're seeing today do about it?
Everybody needs to take a stand, basically. Everybody needs to stand up for what's right. And that can be done in a number of ways. It can be done just by voting. But at the same time, we have to recognize that there is this issue and that we all need to get political. Basically, to get active, to do something about what's going on. It's one thing to understand and see what's going on, but there's something else in actually taking action and doing something.
To stand up and speak out, just like your grandparents did and all of the other parents and children back in the 1930s who helped to desegregate a school right here in Lemon Grove in San Diego's East County.
That's correct. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roberto. It's been an honor. Thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you very much, and it's been an honor to represent community, to represent Lemon Grove, and to be able to say a few words about how important it is to be active, to be concerned with social justice. Thank you.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.